Inch by inch, row by row, gonna make this garden grow. All it takes is a rake and a hoe and a piece of fertile ground.
Good morning, and welcome to the Garden Goddess Show on WDRT 91.9 FM, Viroqua, Wisconsin. This is Donna Smith, and we're going to talk about all things gardening. My guest today is Jillian Varney from Small Family Farm in LaFarge, Wisconsin. Jillian is going to share ideas for what to do with the bounty of produce you're getting from your vegetable garden this season. She has some great ideas for what to do with all of that produce and vegetables, so stay tuned. Let's start off today's show with a couple of questions from the garden cart. If you have a question about something going on in your garden or want some advice, you can email me. If you're curious about a garden-related topic that you'd like me to cover in a future show, let me know that too. Send an email with questions or suggestions to gardening@wdrt.org, and I'll respond on a future show. Our first question came from a listener who asked, "What is the shiny bug that's all over my garden, chewing on my roses and other plants?" This is the Japanese beetle. They feed on over 300 different species of plants and turf grass roots. The adult beetles feed on the leaves, on the upper surface, and what remains in the leaf has a lace-like appearance after the beetles eat the green portion between the leaf veins. Feeding damage causes leaves to turn brown and eventually fall off the plant. The plants aren't typically killed by the beetles, however. By the time the damage occurs, the leaves have produced most of the plant's food for the growing season. The damage is really more cosmetic in nature. The beetles feed for a number of weeks, then lay their eggs in the soil of your lawn, and the larval stage of the beetle, a grub, feeds on your lawn's roots, causing more damage. This is the more harmful stage of the beetle, causing dead spots in your lawn. There are several different ways to control Japanese beetles. Knocking the adult beetles off the plant into a bucket of soapy water is the most environmentally friendly method of control. You'll find the largest numbers congregated on your plants in the morning. This won't totally rid your garden of the pest, but it can cut down on the severity of the infestation. Japanese beetles fly away quickly when disturbed, so spraying the beetle with an insecticide is not a highly recommended method of control. A more effective control would be to begin at the grub stage of the insect. Early season applications of environmentally friendly products such as BTG or Bacillus thuringiensis gonorrhea or milky spore disease may produce better results for controlling this pest. Both products are applied to your soil in your lawn and are effective at controlling the grubs of Japanese beetles specifically. Milky spore disease will take several years to build up in the soil to provide control. Both products are non-toxic to beneficial insects, such as earthworms, bees, and pollinators. Avoid the use of other pesticides on your lawn when using these products, and always follow all label directions when applying any pesticide in your garden. Other methods to reduce the beetles in your yard is to add plants not favored by the beetle. Intersperse them to help reduce plant damage. A few of the resistant plant species you might add to your landscape include clematis, dogwood, coreopsis, feverfew, lilac, pine, oak, juniper, onions, sage, and yarrow. Another thing you can do is to reduce your lawn irrigation. Eggs and young grubs in the lawn cannot survive in relatively dry soils, so avoid watering lawns during June, July, and August when there is more beetle activity. Last but not least, keep plants healthy and vigorous, and in most cases, they'll tolerate the Japanese beetle damage. For other control methods and lists of resistant plant varieties, consult the Extension Service websites in your area. You'll find information through University of Wisconsin-Madison, Minnesota, Illinois, and Michigan State. The next question comes from Paul. He asks, "The tree we planted a couple of months ago has a watering bag on it. Should we still be filling it every day or less often? Great question. Irrigation bags are good for watering small, newly planted trees and shrubs. I've used these bags and found a great explanation on the Morton Arboretum website, mortonarb.org. Irrigation bags are available in an upright version for newly planted small trees or a flat one that looks like a big donut. The donut style is good for low-branched evergreens and shrubs. After placing it around the tree, the bag is filled with water, which seeps out slowly through holes in the bottom of the bag. Water added to the bag will be directed into the root ball of the newly planted tree and not spread out beyond it, where there are no roots yet to take up the water. The bags hold several gallons of water, so you know how much you're giving your tree. Check your bags to be sure that water is seeping out the bottom. Sometimes the holes get clogged or blocked. Paul's question was, how often do you fill the bag? When temperatures are moderate and there's been some rainfall, every 5 to 7 days may be enough. During weeks of extreme heat, the bag may need to be filled every 3 to 5 days. Check the soil under the bag to determine the need to refill it. Lift up the bag and feel the soil underneath it. If the soil's still moist, no need to refill that bag. If the soil is dry an inch or two down, it may be a good time to refill the bag. Bags should be removed in late fall, dried out, and stored for the winter. I'd like to welcome my guest, Jillian Varney, to today's show. Thanks for coming by, Jillian.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Donna.
It's great to have you here.
Happy to be here.
Jill and her husband, Adam, own a CSA farm called Small Family Farm in Lafarge, Wisconsin, just outside of Viroqua. Jill, can you explain briefly for us, what is a CSA farm?
Sure. Well, CSA stands for Community Supported Agriculture, and it's where people in a community sign up. They give the farm a check at the beginning of the season between like $350 and $750, and then that buys them a share in the farm. And then in return, the farm packs them a weekly box of vegetables. So they can get a weekly box. It's like a 3/4 bushel box that they get delivered to a pickup site in near where they live. And it's each box has between 10 to 15 different items in it. And sometimes there's a head of lettuce. In the spring, the boxes are like lettuce, asparagus, radishes, pak choi, spring turnips, you know, and as the season progresses, they'll have more in the summer. They'll be like tomatoes, sweet corn, green beans, peppers, eggplants, all the things that it's all what's in season and fresh, local and organic, totally seasonal. And it usually runs from about June to October. So, you know, people in the community pay up front in the beginning of the season, and in return, they get a weekly or biweekly box based on what they sign up for all throughout the season.
Well, that's awesome.
Yeah.
And my husband PJ and I have met Jill and Adam about 7 years ago already.
Oh my gosh, so much time.
Yeah.
That went by fast.
And we became worker shares.
Yay.
At the farm, which entitles us then to a weekly box of vegetables for the time that we put in to work at the farm. And having been a horticulturist and then yes. working at the farm,
right.
You know, there's a lot that goes into planting and weeding and
right.
watering.
Oh, my gosh.
And doing
yes.
all those things. And it's so totally worth it when you get this beautiful box of vegetables
right.
that are organic.
Yes.
And that you get to eat
right.
throughout the summer.
Yeah. I have some worker share friends, some people who do the worker share, who say, they're like, you know, I couldn't spend 3.5 hours a week at home in my own garden and get this much food, and it's already harvested and washed and packed. And not only I'm like, yeah, they come to the farm and they get their box, but then they're spending 3.5 hours of their time doing it, but they're also getting like community experience. They're working with their friends. They're getting exercise and sunshine. And sometimes gardening is a thing that people do at home alone too. So
right.
it's like a community experience. So yeah, what I love about the worker share too is that it makes it affordable, because sometimes that $750 for the full share is like a big number for some families, and mm-hmm. it just makes it where it's a totally free, like, barter exchange, like a totally,
right.
And that just feels really good to have that option for people. And it helps us tremendously with, like, our labor costs too. So when people come out and do the worker share, we're not necessarily paying them, but it's such a great, I feel like, win-win on both sides. So
yeah.
I just love it.
How many employees do you have, and how many worker shares help
sure.
you out?
So we had, yeah, that number fluctuates a little bit every year, but worker shares might be like 15 to 18. In some years we've had 20 to 25. It all depends on the year. But yeah, it probably hovers close to 20, maybe in the high teens. And then we're, employees are around 15 people also, and that's everything. So some people work one day a week. We have a good number of people that do like one day a week, and then a lot of people do that 3-4 days a week. So yeah, I know it's kind of it's a wide range, because I think farming is very physically demanding work,
right?
And we try to make that part-time work really accessible to people, so they can come and work one or two days. When they do show up, they're really like excited to be at the farm,
sure.
really energized for their work. They're like, I'm so happy to be here today. I love working at the farm. And they can really give it their all for one or two days versus like every day.
Right.
On their knees, like picking, you know, weeding or whatever. So I love that we can do the part-time for people too. So
yeah. And
yeah.
We like the camaraderie
yes.
of coming there and
yes.
you know, and we've had great conversations about everything from music to food.
Oh my gosh.
And,
yeah.
You
things
know,
people,
and everything in between.
Yes. Yeah.
You know,
people
it's
talk
a really
about their
fun
childhoods
time.
And things come out. They're like, oh, you have all this time for talking. And people just, you know, we've got people in their 60s and 70s. We've got people who are 16. You know, this is the range too. It's very inclusive. We're not excluding or only taking people of a certain age or physical ability. So, yeah. That's great too.
Yeah.
We have a
great time at the
yes.
farm, and
yeah.
and then, you know, we just love that benefit of getting a box
yeah.
of veggies. Because our first year at our house, we tried growing some vegetables in containers and didn't have very good luck with that.
Right.
And then we realized that once we started doing the worker share program,
right.
we had more than enough produce
right.
all year
right.
that we don't need to grow anything
right.
on our own.
Right.
Last year, I did try some potatoes in containers, which turned out great.
Yes. Oh, yes.
But
we
get plenty of potatoes from the farm,
yes.
too. So
yeah.
it's not really all that necessary
yeah.
for us to do that. So
yes.
we have time to do other things. And,
right.
you know, I have plenty of other garden space that I can be working on.
Yeah.
But today we really wanted to talk about that abundance of produce that you do get, either from a CSA box
right.
or from growing your own in your garden, because there are so many people around here also put in their own gardens and grow all
right.
their own food. At times, you get a little overwhelmed.
Right.
You know, it's PJ and I at our house. At the beginning of the season, we usually are really good at being able to eat up most of what we get in that week.
Right.
You know, we have the endless container of salad in our
right.
refrigerator that we just keep refilling
right.
with all of the
yes.
spinach and the
yeah.
lettuce and,
right.
and the bok choy and all those things
yeah.
just go into the salad. But then we get to a point at some point in time into the season, and then all of a sudden it's like, oh my gosh, I can't figure out what to
mm-hmm.
do with all this, and I don't want to throw it out,
mm-hmm.
and we're running out of freezer space.
Right, yes.
you know, because I'm like
right.
blanching things and freezing them. And
right.
so what kinds of things do you do
yeah.
to preserve that abundance of food that you are getting from the garden? And what kinds of things, you know, recipes and things do you share with others
right.
to help them along this journey?
Yeah. Well, this is such a fun topic too. And one thing I wanted to say too, right, sort of preceding into that, is that, yeah, you don't have, with the CSA, you don't really have an option of what comes in your box. We just are giving people this big box of produce, and sometimes they're receiving items they've never cooked with before or have no idea what to do with.
Right.
And so those items can go to waste. So we do send out a weekly newsletter as well, where people get a recipe ideas in their box of what things, you know, pictures, and a lot of times I'll just peruse the internet and pull some really great recipes that look good to me. And a lot of times we'll put recipes out for vegetables that are less familiar, like the more challenging. I'll maybe if there's, salad turnips in the box, or if there's kohlrabis, or they've gotten kohlrabis 4 weeks in a row now, and just really want to give them some fresh ideas. So we'll try to include recipes for like what might seem like a challenging item, or Swiss chard or collards or sometimes some things like that. So,
yeah.
The other thing I wanted to say is that I do feel like everything is delicious. All these vegetables, the celeriac root and eggplants, there's things that people have say like, oh, I don't eat that, or I don't like that.
Right.
And I really do feel like all these vegetables are delicious. I'm a little biased because I am a vegetable farmer and I love almost all the vegetables, but I think everything's delicious if it's prepared correctly, if it's prepared right. So it really is finding a recipe that you love, something. And sometimes like things that I love to cook or to do with my Swiss chard, you might not like. So it's really just continuing to find recipes until you try recipes and using Google searches, finding blogs you like, a couple like food blogs that you really, that you love, and people that are fun for you to check out their blog.
I was intimidated by eggplant.
Yes.
Because one time I got an eggplant and I tried cooking it and it just was so bitter.
Right.
So then sometimes I'll see the eggplant come in my box and I'm like, what am I going to do with this?
Right, yeah.
And so I had some friends over last year, and we ended up making like a lasagna.
Right.
And used the eggplant to make, instead of the noodles, used the eggplant.
Oh,
and it was so delicious.
Yeah. Did you salt them first and let them sweat too a little bit?
Yeah, I think we did that.
Yeah, yeah. I know. I do feel like, even if it's something that you really don't know that you're going to like, you could try like pureeing it into a soup
did. I was telling you earlier that I'd always eaten kohlrabi just cold. Just peeled it and sliced it and just, made it into almost like carrot stick size pieces.
Right.
And then just ate it like that, or chopped it up and put it in a salad. And then we were at someone's house and they had pan fried it.
Yes.
In butter and olive oil and a little bit of salt and pepper. And it was so delicious.
So delicious.
And I'm like, I had never thought to cook kohlrabi.
Right.
I thought it was a vegetable you just ate cold.
Right. Yes. Yes. Yeah, I know. And like with Swiss chard, that was one that people that struggle with. But I learned that I really like it because it has that earthy flavor. Mm-hmm. But I learned I really like it just sort of if you simmer, or you kind of cook it, blanch it in cold water or boiling water, and then you puree it and you make like a spinach stuffed shell. So I love it with pasta. Ooh. There's some really great Swiss chard recipes where you can like chop it up and put it in muffins, like savory cheesy muffins with Swiss chard.
Oh, wow.
Or you can just get so creative.
Yeah, I think the finding those recipes from friends and neighbors or looking on the various food blogs and things like that.
Right.
That's kind of one of my first steps nowadays is I'll take a vegetable and then I'll just Google that and say, recipes with kohlrabi. Or I did that with radishes and found the most delicious radish cream.
Yes.
That's like a dip. Use it in place of mayonnaise on a sandwich. I found one for like a roasted radishes. And I was like, I never thought to roast radishes. They were always that, little red vegetable that my mom just sliced up and threw in a salad.
Right. Yeah. And they can be good pickled too. So good. But yeah, and I was going to say eggplants. My mom makes these really delicious eggplant Parmesan dishes, or we'll make like little eggplant Parmesan stacks. So yeah, if you salt them and sweat them and then let them kind of give off some of that moisture, but fry them a little bit on the stovetop and then bread them, but then covering them with Parmesan cheese and tomato sauce. And I just feel like even my kids who say they don't like eggplant do love eggplant Parmesan. So I do feel like, and kids are the worst critics, so they will turn their nose up at anything. But
yeah, I think we tried that eggplant stack.
Yes.
I think you included that recipe in one of the newsletters.
Yes.
And I think we did try that and we enjoyed it very much.
Another one last summer that I learned finally, I mean, I'd always seen galettes when I was on the computer, like looking for recipes, but I started trying galettes, which is basically where you're making like a pie crust and you're rolling it out and you can saute all kinds of, this tomato pie is similar to your tomato pie. We should talk about that too.
Yeah.
But where you just make these tomato crust, you can put for a galette, you could put your Swiss chard in there. You can put tomatoes, sautéed onions and garlic, cheeses. And then you just sort of like fold the edges over to keep everything from oozing out as you bake it. But then you bake it at 450 and it's just so crispy and delicious. You could put anything in a galette and with a pie crust. I love pie crust. So if you like pie crust and you're not scared of gluten, then galettes are a lot of fun.
Yeah. See, I've always thought of galettes as being something that you put fruit in.
Yes.
But you could do them with
savory,
like vegetables and cheese.
Yeah,
and,
so good. Yes.
Ooh,
yeah. Yeah.
That would be
it's almost like an open face, like a pizza almost, but more of a pie crust versus a bread dough, you know?
Sure. What other ways can people preserve some of that food?
Yeah, I find this very personal too, because some people love canning, and then there's people who are like, give me ideas, but don't make me can. You know, they don't ever want to have to can anything.
Well, we're so intimidated by the whole canning process.
Sure, right. Canning can be very intimidating. So if you want to can and you want to learn, I feel like there's a lot of safety in the Ball Blue Book recipe. You know, get that Ball Blue Book. That book will show you how to can anything under the sun. And if you're just canning what's in your CSA box, you're only talking about a few jars of things.
Right. It's not like you're making like 3 dozen jars of tomato sauce or something like that. You could do do a small amount.
Right.
I did try canning on my own.
Yes.
I came across somebody on the internet who was offering, you know, like the little free class, and we made a tomato soup.
Oh, yeah.
But she went through all of the steps how to do that. And then I made like, I think it just, the recipe was like 6 pint jars.
Right.
So it was one batch.
Yes.
And that's all
that's
I had to
manageable.
Do.
Right.
And I could use a little bit better of a pot to put it in, but what I had worked okay.
Right.
You know, so great to know that you don't have to do that. You could you could just can a couple
three jars if you want or do what's manageable or I'm also was going to say we got a steam canner this last summer. A friend of mine told me about steam canners. I don't know if you have one of these, but there's the two methods that most people know about, which is the water bath canning, the big, you know, the big thing with the lid, and then also the pressure canning, which some people are scared of because it's there's so much pressure built up. But these steam canners are really cool because you can just put like 2 inches of water at the bottom of it, and it has the big deep lid, almost like a cake. The top of a cake pan or whatever.
Okay.
And then you can just put your jars in cold or, you know, like, because the other thing that can happen when you're water bath canning is you're dropping jars and down into boiling water and the jar can break, but you're much less likely to get breaking because you can just setting them on top of the boiling water and you're like steaming them, and then they steam for the appropriate normal amount of time that you would water bath can. I think I might have to double check that online, but and then there's a little gauge on top that once it gets up to pressure, and then you let them sit there for however many minutes they're supposed to be canning for. But my mom's been canning with us on the farm for 25 years, and she we transitioned to the steam canner last year and really, really loved that. So that was a big revolution for us.
So that's something that people can check out. And you can also, do you do any dehydrating?
We do quite a bit of dehydrating. Yeah. Several years ago for Christmas, we invested in an Excalibur dehydrator. So this is my favorite kind. And you can find these on used online, but it's like this big square thing. It's square and it has 9 trays on it. And they're each tray is square, but you can put a lot of produce on these trays. And then you can adjust the temperature from 105 to all the way up to like, 200 degrees or whatever, however hot that goes. But we do a lot of herbs from the garden, a lot of parsley and thyme and sage. We actually dry the kids in it. We dry a lot of apples, and we were drying melon, dehydrated watermelon.
Oh.
A lot of sweet, like the fruits and things like that. But we do a lot of freezing for our family. So we freeze a lot of sweet corn. We freeze a lot of sweet peppers as well. We freeze a lot of broccoli, cauliflower, and greens.
I did a lot of kale.
So nice.
Yeah.
Yes. And sometimes I'll take, when I've got time on a weekend, I'll bring a whole bin of kale up, strip the kale off the leaves, and then plunk it in boiling water. Give it like one minute in the boiling water, and that just kind of like that breaks it down. It stops those live enzymes and you can also then at that point compress it down, and you can fit a lot of kale in a little quart Ziploc bag.
Sure.
So really jam it in there. And then if I have 20 bags of that in the freezer for the winter, it's really nice. We can pull those out. We'll put the kale or any kind of blanched and frozen green in like frittatas in the winter. We'll put them in chicken noodle soup. We'll put them in, put them on pizza. We put kale on pizza, homemade pizza a lot. Just find anything I'm making. If I'm like, I'll just ask myself, can I get greens in this dish? Because we always try to get greens in.
Right.
And then, like you said, you can pull the kale out of the freezer and just cut a little off or, break a little off. And then if you just want a little in. So it's really, and we do put cooking greens in almost every box throughout the season too. So you do get a lot of cooking greens that can be kale, chard, collards. So it is nice to know how to preserve greens if you can't keep up with it in the summer. Or like, oh, I've got a lot of tomatoes. I really want to eat those. I'm going to blanch and freeze my kale or just freeze it if that works. If you've done that, not even blanch and freeze it.
So
we make a lot of fajitas in the winter too. So I'll pull a bag of peppers out of the freezer, and peppers and onions sauteed with some meat. And then you've got cheese and sour cream and a tortilla. So we eat that a lot because it's a quick meal that we all love.
Everybody loves it.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. All right.
Yeah.
Well, we have already talked for 20 minutes.
Oh my gosh. Wow.
So we're going to have to wrap up, but so thankful that Jill was able to come in today.
Oh gosh.
So hopefully you've gotten some ideas about doing a little canning, freezing, maybe some dehydrating. We never even made it to fermenting. We'll have to talk about that again another time.
Okay. Another show.
Yep. Yes. But lots of great ideas if you need to look at Jill's website is
smallfamilycsa.com.
You can go back and look at some of their old newsletters and get some of those great recipes from Jill, and all the links to those recipes are in their newsletters. So thanks again for coming in.
Yay, thanks for having me, Donna.
All right.
So fun.
On the bookshelf this month are two cookbooks that you may want to check out. First is From Asparagus to Zucchini, a guide to cooking farm fresh seasonal produce. And the second book is Farm Fresh and Fast, easy recipes and tips for making the most of your fresh seasonal foods. Both books are by Fair Share CSA Coalition. Combined, these books have over 700 recipes, plus additional resources for you to get the most meals from your harvest. You can purchase either book on the Small Family Farm website, smallfamilycsa.com. In today's Garden Journal, let's take a look at some things you can be doing in the coming month. As our temperatures moderate in late summer, it's a good time to think about establishing a new lawn or to overseed bare spots in your yard. Thinking about next year's garden, late summer into early fall is a good time to add new perennials to the garden and also divide your spring and summer flowering perennials. Keep newly divided and planted perennials watered, which will help them get well established before winter. Continue with your weeding and monitoring the garden for insect and disease problems. Start thinking about your spring flowering bulbs to plant this fall. Get your orders in now. Harvest and hang flowers such as strawflower, status, and celosia for drying. I'll have a guest on a future show to talk more about drying plants from your garden. I want to thank my guest, Jillian Varney, for joining me on today's show, and thank you so much for listening. Please join me again next month for another discussion about gardening and plants. Have a wonderful day. Let's go out and make our world a little more beautiful, one plant at a time.